Yesterday, Washington became the seventh state to recognize gay marriage, and recently the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals held up a ruling overturning Proposition 8 in California. But according to my next guest, Christopher Bram, those advances in gay rights would not have been possible were it not for a long list of gay writers in the second half of the 20th century. He's called his book Eminent Outlaws, The Gay Writers Who Changed America. It's published by 12, and I'm pleased to welcome Mr. Bram to our show today. Hello.
Hello. It's great to be here today.
You open the introduction of your book by saying the gay revolution began as a literary revolution. Why do you think that writing is at the center of the American gay rights movement?
Because it had to go public. Stories had to be told about people whose lives were silenced, whose lives were secrets. And their lives, interestingly enough, were love stories. So it lends itself to fiction. I mean, so much literature is about love stories, but what is homosexuality but just another love story with a twist? So these stories had to be told before gay people could know there were other people like them, before straight people could know there were just these other people out in the world that were unlike what they knew.
Before this generation of writers, there was gay literature, but it was mostly underground.
It was kind of small presses. In the 30s, there were several books. There were several writers we now know were gay. Henry James, Willa Cather.
Well, Henry James is still unclear whether he even ever had sex.
So. No, yeah, but he fell in love with. We do know he fell in love with men, but you're right. We don't know if
Thomas Mann was gay in his head, but he probably never had a relationship with a man.
No, probably not.
So it gets more complicated. But did the writers you're talking about know each other?
Many of them did, which was kind of great for me telling their story because it became the story of both friendships and feuds.
You write, before gay experience crossed over into other media, it energized American literature in much the same way Jewish experiences energized it in the 50s and 60s, and feminism energized it in the 70s, introducing new subjects and fresh points of view. What did these writers bring to literature that was different?
Mainly just a new way of thinking about love and sex. That difference was that people are much more complicated than we really think, that the conventions don't really hold true. And sometimes they did this by writing openly about gay men. Other times they had a different point of view on straight people. I mean, Tennessee Williams being one of the most. I mean, Tennessee Williams was gay. He would write about it just now and then, very guardedly. It was in there. But he saw straight people differently than anybody else had. I mean, it was kind of a fresh point of view that I think was really important to his work.
You're saying because he was writing it from the outside?
He was writing it from the outside. He saw it new. He saw it differently. He saw it without the conventions.
Do you think these writers were driving social change in their minds, or were they just responding to other things that were happening at the time?
I think these were stories they wanted to tell for themselves, that they were stories nobody else was telling. It spoke to them. It kind of excited them, and they thought, there's a niche out here. There's a blank spot, and I can fill it. That it was going to change things in the long run. For the longest time, most of them didn't even consider that.
Well, what happened after World War II that even allowed some of these writers, to write about homosexuality pretty openly? Was it because the Kinsey Report was released around the same time?
Interesting. The Kinsey Report came out the same month, actually within weeks, of both Gore Vidal's novel, The City and the Pillar, and Truman Capote's Other Voices, Other Rooms.
But neither of those were gay novels.
Although they're very gay novels. City and the Pillar is a completely gay novel. It's about a young man who, it opens with him having sex with a schoolmate on a camping trip, and he spends the rest of the novel in love with him, looking for another friend to substitute for that man. Other Voices, Other Rooms is a little more... It's not really coded. It's a strange kind of fairy tale set in 1930s South. But there is a cousin, Randolph, a gay man, who's still in love with a boxer he met in Mexico.
So gay figures here were depicted in a positive way?
They were depicted. The most important thing is they were depicted, because before there was silence. They were depicted with sympathy. Maybe sometimes it bordered into pity, but the important thing is that they were depicted.
The reason I ask is there were gay figures earlier. For example, in the movies, there were the characters of Franklin Pangborn, played. They were comic prissy.
The Great Sissy, yeah.
So that changed here.
That changed. This was about, these were the protagonists. I mean, somebody like Franklin Pangborn, who's a great comedian in these movies, he was secondary. He was like just comic relief. These were stories that were about the men themselves and their lives.
Yeah, well, Franklin Pangborn served the same function that Stephen Fetchett had served in kind of also making minority people into laughing stocks or less than human. Tennessee Williams, James Baldwin, Gore Vidal, Truman Capote, and others started publishing about two decades before Stonewall. Was there a fixed gay political identity then?
Not really. And it was very kind of mixed, very confusing. They would, I mean, Tennessee Williams is a good case in point. He would write matter-of-factly about homosexuality with secondary characters, but not without with primary characters, until Cat on the Hot Tin Roof. And he realized that Brick was gay, but he didn't want to say it. And Ilya Kazan, his director, was kind of arguing, come on, go ahead and make him gay. And Williams didn't. He had a nervous breakdown almost as a result of this. He kept rewriting the last act. And then when trying to hide what was really there, and then when reviewers still saw it, and reviewers weren't shocked, they just said, oh, Brick is in love with Skipper. And he became very upset.
He became upset. It's pretty clear. Audience. I mean, he must have known that audiences would see that. There are scenes where he talks so lovingly about Skipper that it's impossible not to notice.
No, it's very strange, but writers are unconscious is often smarter than we are and willing to take more risks, and we'll kind of just let it go, and then we'll say, oh my God, what have I revealed?
Now, why do you think Tennessee Williams was so concerned about that? After all, most people knew he was gay, didn't they?
His friends certainly knew he was gay. I don't really know. It's a strange sort of period there where he was having trouble with his drinking. He was having an emotional breakdown. He started seeing a psychiatrist, Dr. Lawrence Kuby, who tried to cure him of being gay, who also tried to cure him of being a writer, or at least that's how Williams interpreted the sessions. And so he became very confused for this period in the 50s.
Did any of these writers write openly about being gay? And I'm talking about essays or treatises.
For the longest time, not really. Even Gore Vidal, who did some amazing he got kicked in the teeth for City in the Pillar, for writing this openly gay novel, which isn't really autobiographical, but reviewers assumed, rightly, that only a gay man could write this book. So he then kind of became more coded and wrote more indirectly. And then he hit upon this kind of brilliant strategy of saying, oh, there's no such thing as a homosexual person. There's only homosexual acts. Homosexual is a adjective and not a noun. And he said, argued everybody's bisexual. And then once he had come up with that argument, he wrote openly about his own pansexuality, about the pansexuality of everyone in his essays, which are really one. I love his essays a lot.
Although that argument isn't necessarily convincing to everyone.
No, it's not. And I think at a certain point, when the Times kind of outpaced him and he still clung to it, everybody was like, oh, come on, Gore. You can let go now. You don't need it anymore.
Now, Gore Vidal and Truman Capote were also friends with Tennessee Williams, although Tennessee Williams was older than they were. But then Vidal and Capote developed a strong dislike for each other. How did they go from being best friends to being enemies?
I think it was competitiveness. Early on when they met before either of them had really published their major work, and they were quite friendly initially. They met at Anais Nin's apartment. They even went to the baths together one night, which is kind of an amazing thing to picture, the two of them in towels at the baths. But Capote wanted to talk, and Vidal wanted to go off and meet somebody. But then Capote started getting more attention as a writer. He got better reviews for Other Voices, Other Rooms than Vidal did for City in the Pillar. And as time went on, Vidal would be polite about it. He would also say, we've got to support each other. But the resentment and the rivalry kind of grew, especially on his side. And as he started saying nasty things, Capote started to fight back.
Well, they both had a love of gossip that a lot of other writers don't have, but they love to talk about what other people are doing, and that got them all sorts of other enemies, didn't
yes.
it? At what point did we suddenly start seeing gay bookstores and as ways for people to like-minded people to meet?
Gay bookstores were very, very important to the literary movement, to the whole gay liberation movement. It was a man named Craig Rodwell opened the first one, Oscar Wilde Memorial Books, here in New York in 1968. And interestingly, Rodwell wasn't terribly interested in literature himself, but he wanted an alternative to the bars. He thought books were the way to get the message across.
And the cops were less likely to raid a bookstore.
Exactly, yes.
Now, Gore Vidal wrote fiction, was also an essayist, and the same was true of James Baldwin. But you note that Baldwin often addressed sexuality in his fiction and race in his essays and journalism. Why did he separate the two? Do we know?
We don't really know. Earlier, before we talked about how did these men talk about their own sexuality openly, and it was very difficult at this time. It was, remember, in 1948, homosexuality was illegal in all 48 states. You could still be prosecuted for sending magazines and material through the mails. And Baldwin didn't write about it in his essays, and he wrote about it in his fiction. In Giovanni's Room, which is about two white men falling in love in Paris, which he published in the mid-50s, his agent hated it. His agent wanted him to burn it. His publisher, Knopf, said, "We're not going to publish it, and we're protecting you." Also, the publisher was afraid they would be sued for publishing obscenity. They could be charged with publishing obscenity. So Baldwin published it in England. It was a success. Another publisher picked it up in the United States. It was a bestseller. So he could write about his sexuality in his fiction, later on also in another country, was kind of very open about it, but was much more worried, nervous, anxious when it came to the nonfiction, to the essays. I think part of it is fiction is closer to the body, is about your skin and your physical life. Essays are more about the brain, and so you can kind of separate the two.
My guest is Christopher Bram, who's written essays and reviews along with fiction. He is the author of 9 novels, including The Father of Frankenstein, which was made into the Academy Award-winning movie Gods and Monsters. His latest book, Eminent Outlaws, The Gay Writers Who Changed America. It is published by 12. Now, there had been earlier writers who had touched on gay themes. There are homoerotic overtones in parts of Moby Dick, and Proust's Baron de Charlus was an openly gay character. There were others in literature. Did they influence the American writers of this generation that you're talking about?
I think so. Proust particularly. Truman Capote loved Proust. Later on, Edmund White loved Proust. They were walking in Proust's footsteps. Proust does this just enormous canvas of French social life with one of the greatest gay characters ever written. Yes, the Baron Charlus is an amazing multidimensional character who keeps showing us new sides.
There are also there was Cole Porter, who most people read gay into some of his lyrics. Allen Ginsberg was openly gay. Frank O'Hara. The poets were held to a different standard.
The poets broke through, I think, before the novelists did. Ginsberg with Howl, which was published in the early 50s, just powerful kind of outpouring of energy and sexuality. And it was led to a famous law case in San Francisco when the San Francisco police seized it and for obscenity and charged his publisher with distributing obscene work. And the trial got a lot of attention nationwide. And so it made Howl became a bestseller. For a book of poems, it's very rare.
You write, "It's difficult to keep one's real sexuality buried for too long without the work suffering." In the 50s and early 60s, did many gay writers have to switch to more coded systems when they're talking about their gay life?
They did. One of my favorite writers that I write about is Christopher Isherwood. And he was able for the longest time to just he would leave himself, his sexuality, out of the story. He would tell the truth. He wouldn't lie about himself. But it became frustrating. He would, because he lived a very gay life, he wanted, that kept spilling into the work. And with one of my favorite books of his, Down There on a Visit, we don't know the narrator is Christopher Isherwood. And we don't know his love life at all, but he is friends with several gay people. He thought, okay, this is a good cover-up for me. I can get away with this. But the book got torn to shreds as being, world is just one big Sodom, was one of, to this man, was one of the reviews. So he decided, okay, I'm not going to write gay anymore. The next book will be about an English woman, and I'm going to leave my sexuality out of it at all, completely. And he couldn't do it. He just was blocked and miserable, and he realized, I've got to tell the truth, and he wrote A Single Man, which is one of his greatest books.
And later in his life, he went on the Dick Cavett Show, and they talked about being gay. So I guess things had changed by then. But in 1966, Time magazine ran a one-page essay called The Homosexual in America, which stated, homosexual ethics and aesthetics are staging a vengeful, derisive counterattack on what deviants called the straight world. So they were talking about how gays were attacking heterosexuality.
There's a strange kind of homosexual panic in the mid-60s, and we most famous because of the attacks on Edward Albee's Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. And Virginia Woolf, when it first opened, received all this praise. People loved it. They loved the language, the honesty about a marriage. Then within a year, word got out that Albee was gay. He was openly gay, never hid it. And critics turned against the play. They argued, this isn't really about us. This is about a bunch of homosexuals, and it's disguised as normal people. It's not telling the truth.
And you kind of suggest that you believe that's true. But Edward Albee, I've talked to him about this a number of times. He says it's not true.
Oh, no, I think it is a straight couple. And as Albee himself has said, gay people and gay couples and straight couples, they argue the same way. There's no real difference.
But why do you think there are so many of the best writers wrote for theater? Albee, Tennessee Williams, Tony Kushner, Larry Kramer wrote The Normal Heart, which is an amazing play. Is it because theater was more welcoming to gays?
Ultimately, theater was more welcoming. Also, there are more gay people in the theater with actors, directors, designers. And in time, the audiences were, too. The whole attack of Albee for Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf was like an early... Once they got it out of their system, the theater world was much more accepting of gay material than they'd been before.
You called The Object of My Affection by Stephen Macaulay the strongest and most successful work of this period. Why? It's probably the least well-known of all the things we're discussing.
Well, it's the most successful in terms of sales. It became very popular. There's a lot of talk about crossover. When do gay books, when are they read by straight people? And Object of My Affection was one that was clearly read by straight people.
And that is the problem in when people put things into a genre. Many gay writers say, I'm just writing literature. Some of my characters are gay.
Mm-hmm.
So where do you think gay writing is today?
There's still a lot of terrific stuff being done. Right now, publishing is in transition, and there's a kind of hard time to find a play or... It's difficult to find a place for what are known as mid-list books. And almost all gay fiction is by nature mid-list. It's not going to become a huge bestseller. So there's great stuff being done, but it's being done by smaller publishers. In much the same way in the early 50s, there was a period where the big publishers didn't want to touch gay fiction, and smaller houses did it instead.
Although I assume that Knopf regretted later that they hadn't published Giovanni's Room.
I'm sure they did. And then they later got Baldwin back as an author.
Christopher Bram will be giving a reading and signing books tonight at 7 o'clock at the KGB Bar on East 4th Street. That's between the Bowery and 2nd Avenue. And then again on March 1st at 7 o'clock at Three Lives and Company at 154 West 10th Street. His book called Eminent Outlaws, The Gay Writers Who Changed America, is published by 12. And I want to thank you so much for being on our show today.
Oh, well, great to be here. Thank you for having me.